This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I am Dracula. I bid you welcome. Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they make.
On this archive edition, in the spirit of Halloween, we've brought garlic into the Fresh Air Crypt to scare out the vampire interviews, which we will present to you today. David Skahl is an expert on vampires and horror films. He's co-editor of the 100th anniversary edition of Dracula, which reprints Bram Stoker's novel along with reviews and essays. Skahl is also the author of Hollywood Gothic, The Monster Show, and Dark Carnival, a biography of Todd Browning, who directed the Bela Lugosi version of Dracula. Last year, I asked Skahl why he thinks we're so captivated by the idea of vampires.
Well, there hasn't been a human civilization in recorded history that has not had some variation on the theme of the vampire. And our reasons for reviving the vampire theme over and over again in literature and popular culture over the centuries have... There are many different reasons, I think. In our current age, I think it is rather obvious that this huge vampire renaissance in the last 10 years has had everything to do with the parallel AIDS epidemic and our cultural fixation on frightening themes having to do with blood and blood contact. And I think Anne Rice, of course, whose novels are very much one of the driving engines of this vampire revival, is aware of this consciously, and she's played with the metaphor of the vampire as disease. She started writing her vampire chronicles following the death of her young daughter from a blood disease, leukemia. But I think she's also spoken very eloquently about the metaphor she sees connected to the AIDS epidemic. The idea of the vampire as a kind of a symbol for an alternate, supernaturalized kind of sexuality.
Let's look at Dracula, the 1931 Bela Lugosi version, the first American vampire film. Whose idea was it to make the film?
Well, all the studios in Hollywood were interested in the idea of doing Dracula as a film. But in the American film tradition, there were terrifying characters and creatures in the 1920s, but there were no supernatural monsters. If there was a haunting or a horrible character, it would always have to be explained away as the result of a human agency, you know, usually criminal, somebody trying to steal an inheritance or embezzle a fortune. And this is very unlike the European tradition, where the irrational and the fantastic were really part of the European filmmaking tradition from the very beginning, especially in Germany, where we had the prototype horror films like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and Nosferatu. But in America, it was just assumed that the public would not accept these bizarre stories. So even though Dracula as a stage play was making a lot of money, the studios took a long time deciding to whether or not it was worth the gamble. And it was considered a gamble.
Now, how did Bela Lugosi get the part? He had been in the stage version, yes, of Dracula?
Yes. Bela Lugosi came to America as a political expatriate from Hungary in the early 1920s, and where he was very active in the stage, was a member of the National Theater in Budapest, but got on the wrong side of the revolution. So he ended up here in New York playing all kinds of roles, most of them exotic heavies and foreigners. He learned his roles phonetically because he really never mastered English the way he should, one syllable at a time, which, you know, accounts for that amazing and deliberate manner of speaking that we forever associate with Dracula. But he first played Dracula in 1927 on the Broadway stage.
Bela Lugosi gave a performance that has left an indelible mark on the American imagination. What do you think works so well about his performance of Dracula?
Lugosi's performance kind of sums up the entire history of vampire impersonations in the theater and on film. Stoker's Dracula was nothing like the character Lugosi plays, except that he was certainly evil, but he was a horrible old man who got younger as he drank blood. He never really became attractive and was really a largely offstage presence throughout the book. When they did Dracula on the stage, they had to clean up the character because to follow the conventions of a drawing room mystery melodrama, which is how it had to be produced, Dracula had to be rethought as the kind of character you'd plausibly invite into a drawing room. And that's where we got the evening clothes and the slick back hair and the unctuous Transylvanian charm. But with Lugosi, we see both the charmer, the Valentino-like lover from beyond the grave, but also that hint of pure evil. There's nothing sympathetic about Lugosi. He can charm, but just look at those eyes.
The studio that produced Dracula was concerned about homoerotic overtones in the story. What kind of communication did they have with the writer and director about that?
There were some very interesting annotations on Carl Laemmle Jr.'s script. Carl Laemmle Jr. was the producer of Dracula, the son of Carl Laemmle Sr., who inherited the reins of the studio at the age of 21 as a birthday present. And he was very concerned that Dracula was attacking not only women, but some of the sailors on the ship that took him to England, and of course Renfield, the solicitor who comes to his castle. And he wrote frantically in the margins, you know, Dracula should only go for women and not men. But Browning seemed to ignore this bit of advice, and so we do have an aspect of a homoerotic seduction in that scene where Dracula invites Renfield up to his quarters in his castle, and the sexual undercurrents of Dracula have been the subject of a lot of very interesting criticism, mostly in the last 20 years or so. And especially the homoerotic aspects.
Now, the director of Dracula, Todd Browning, he has a little vocal cameo in Dracula, where he's the harbor master who goes aboard the ship that had brought Dracula to his castle. And looking in the shadows, we see the crazy Renfield, who has this unearthly laugh. Well, you got it perfect.
Well, I've seen the movie more times than I have to, than I really should admit, but...
You got it perfect. But, as perfect as it is, I'm going to play the clip from the film so we get to hear the laugh and also the voice of the director, Todd Browning.
They must have come through a terrible storm. What's that? Why, come from that hatchway. Why, he's mad. Look at his eyes. Why, the man's gone crazy.
That's the voice of Todd Browning from his film Dracula. A really interesting sidebar of Dracula is that after that movie was made, there was a Spanish language version of the same movie. Why did they do it? How did they do it?
In the days of the early talkies, half of Hollywood's revenues were coming from the foreign market. And the appeal and novelty of these films was the chance to see actors speaking in their natural voices. So there was great resistance initially to the idea of dubbing films. So for a period of several years, when Hollywood was the only place in the world making sound pictures, simultaneous foreign language renditions were done of the films, not just the soundtracks, but the entire films. They'd be done with different casts, different directors, different photographers. And the Spanish language version of Dracula that was made at night on the same sets as the Browning film was one of the most ambitious. They had an actor, a Spanish actor named Carlos Villarías, play Dracula. He was the only actor who was allowed to watch the rushes because they wanted him to imitate Lugosi as closely as possible.
Wait, so was he supposed to give a Spanish version of an Eastern European accent?
That's an interesting point. One of the reasons these films didn't last all that much longer is that Spanish-speaking audiences around the world were annoyed that Hollywood would just throw together every kind of Spanish accent into one picture. So you'd have actors from Argentina, from Mexico, from Spain— with the clash of all the different accents. To my ear, he sounds pretty Castilian. Whether he was trying to sound like Lugosi is another matter. He did wear the same hairpiece as Lugosi in the film, the identical number. So it really never got a rest. It came off Lugosi's head at dusk and went on Carlos's head until dawn.
Did Dracula start a horror craze in the movies?
Oh, yes. It was a surprise to Universal. They didn't know what to expect. And it ended up saving the studio from bankruptcy. Universal was tottering on the edge of insolvency, as were many of the studios. I mean, this is still in the wake of the stock market crash, of course, in 1930 when the film was filmed. But immediately they rushed into production Frankenstein. Lugosi turned down the part of the monster, something he regretted for the rest of his career, because, of course, he made Boris Karloff a star.
Did Boris Karloff want the part? He was typed as mummies and monsters for years afterwards. Or he was doing something in the laboratory.
Yes. Unlike Lugosi, Karloff had a much more prosperous career playing monsters. I mean, he was struggling and struggling. He appeared in something like 80 films before he made Frankenstein as a bit player and doing character parts. Played a lot of gangsters and things like that. And Frankenstein put him on the map. And he really had no professional difficulties for the rest of his life. He made a lot of money. He managed his career very wisely and was always expressed gratitude, you know, to the monster. Never complained about being typecasting. Oh, he didn't like the word horror movie. He liked to call them terror films. Lugosi, on the other hand, with Dracula, which was his first big break in Hollywood, it was also the beginning of the end of his career, because audiences never really accepted him in other... Perhaps if he had worn some transforming makeup or something in Dracula, he would have had more versatility. But Dracula's face was Lugosi's. The voice of Dracula was Lugosi's. And he really couldn't escape it. In fact, he was buried in makeup and costume as Dracula when he died in 1956. I think it's the only time in theatrical history I know of that a character actor was so identified with a part that he went to the grave in costume.
Did he ask to be buried that way? I hope he wanted it. It'd be pretty miserable if he didn't want that.
Apparently he did mention, it was not in his will, as was reported in the newspapers, but apparently he did mention the wish to friends and the family decided to do this. It's very, very poignant, act.
David Skahl is the author of Hollywood Gothic and The Monster Show. He co-edited the 100th anniversary edition of Dracula.